As the impeachment trial continues in the U.S. Senate, we take a look at the Trump presidency through the eyes of two Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters from The Washington Post. Philip Rucker and Carol Lenig's new book is an unsettling look at the first 2.5 years of the Trump administration. There's the moment when a raging president berates his senior military leaders, calling them losers. Another where he appears not to know what happened at Pearl Harbor. And many instances of erratic decision-making, driven by the whims of a president with little patience for the details of public policy. They write that by 2018, White House advisors had come to expect crises because the president placed so much value in cable news musings and so little in the expertise of his own government. Carol Lenig is a national investigative reporter for The Post. She won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on security failures and misconduct inside the Secret Service. Philip Rucker is The Post's White House bureau chief. He and a team of reporters won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. The title of their book is taken from words President Trump has used to describe himself. It's called A Very Stable Genius. Well, Carol Lenig, Philip Rucker, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk about some of the what you reveal in the book. And I think one of the things that's gotten the most headlines so far are details on a briefing for the president in July of 2017 in the Pentagon. And some of the things the president said have been gotten a lot of attention. But I want you to begin by just telling us, because I find this also interesting, who set up the briefing, why they wanted to do it, and how they structured it to get the president and keep the president's attention.
Yeah, Dave, this meeting was a really important inflection point for President Trump. It was about 6 months into the administration, and his defense secretary, Jim Mattis, his secretary of state, Rex Tillerson, Gary Cohn, the top economic advisor, they were really alarmed by the president's lack of knowledge about the world, by his lack of understanding about military deployments and bases all around the globe, and felt like they needed to basically school him, to tutor him. So they arranged for this meeting at a sacred space in the Pentagon. It's the tank. That's what they call it. It's a private room where decisions of war and peace are determined by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They brought the president there, and they went through a slideshow explaining, you know, where our troops are deployed, why we have the alliances we do, what does NATO do, why do we have so many troops in South Korea, in the Korean Peninsula, to fend off the threat of North Korea. And the president got irritated by the schoolhouse rock vibe in the room, and he ended up barking at the generals in the room and the other advisors. He said, "You're a bunch of dopes and babies." Those are his words. He said, "I wouldn't go to war with you people." And it was a really harrowing moment. It was emotional. Generals who had to cover their eyes because they were so worried about this moment. Vice President Pence didn't say anything, even though his son is in the military. Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, was the only one to stand up to confront the president. And after the meeting ended, he said that the president was an effing moron. And President Trump, if this is how he respects or disrespects, rather, the military leaders, the relationship he has with the people he's going to be counting on to lead Americans into battle, that is alarming for those in the military, according to the people we spoke with.
Right. He said, "I wouldn't go to war with you people. You're losers," right?
That's right. And he called the war in Afghanistan a loser war.
Now, you know, you have direct quotes here, pretty extraordinary quotes, and there's no recording or transcript. How can you be sure of what he said?
We talked to multiple people who were either eyewitnesses to this event or briefed on it later. We had people in the book review their contemporaneous notes, their diaries, their own reflections. We worked our tails off to be sure that we caught as much of this scene as we could, as accurately as we could. And so many people consistently, Dave, described this. And I will add one more thing about the comment that the president made. Many of the people in this room thought that that was the worst insult that anyone could ever say in the tank. "I wouldn't go to war with you people." And many of them vowed never to talk about it publicly until ultimately they shared it with us for this book.
And it's worth adding, Dave, that the dialogue, and we say this in the author's note of the book, cannot necessarily be exact, but it's the absolute best version of the truth that Carol and I were able to determine based on all the reporting, the rigorous reporting that we did with these firsthand sources.
Take us a little bit more inside the give and take here, because the idea was to provide him with some basic information. Give us a sense, I mean, before these explosive comments were exchanged, kind of how the president reacted to this tutorial?
So keep in mind, as Phil described, that these three very senior people in the administration are hopeful about guiding a novice president. They're excited about the opportunity to help teach him. They have been frustrated, to be clear, because he doesn't seem to know why it's important to have these bases that basically, as Matt has said numerous times in this meeting, this is what keeps us safe, Mr. President. And they wanted to help him. But there's something really interesting that comes out in this scene and is repeated over and over again with President Trump, which is he doesn't like people telling him what's going on or what's true or what expertise they bring to bear on a subject. That almost is an insult to him. And he says, you know what? I don't need to hear anymore. I know I have good instincts. And that is basically his reaction in this room. He doesn't enjoy hearing that there should be bases on the Korean Peninsula. He talks about how they need to make some money, why foreign countries need to pay our military to be where they are based, to protect the Middle East or protect Western Europe. He is saying, you know, we need to make money off this. And that is something that just drives so many people in the room bonkers, to the point that Rex Tillerson stands up and says, that's not why people put on a uniform, Mr. President. They're protecting our freedom. It's not about making money. It's not about making a buck.
It was remarkable that Tillerson was the one figure in the room who directly contradicted the president.
You know, one thing about that moment is that both Phil and I found so chilling is that many in the room are waiting for someone to say something, palpably waiting. Mike Pence is like a wax figure. He says nothing, and that really troubles some of the people in the room. Many are waiting for Mattis to say something, but his head is kind of bowed, and it's almost like he's just taking it on the chin. And when he doesn't say anything, that's when Tillerson says, look, I'm gonna have to step in. They all kind of come to some sort of silent acknowledgement that the Pentagon brass can't speak back to their commander in chief.
The other thing that I found interesting about this anecdote is that when these officials, you know, Defense Secretary Mattis, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Gary Cohn, were planning this, they took a lot of care to craft a presentation which they thought would capture and hold the president's attention. How did they do that?
You know, that far into the administration, the advisors learned that the president didn't take briefings like any other president. He doesn't read the intelligence book. He doesn't like to listen to long lectures or explanations about what the intelligence is. He likes to see graphics, videos, charts, dollar signs, his own name. And so what Mattis and Cohn and Tillerson did is they put together a slideshow presentation that would accentuate all of those features, that would have, you know, a map of the world and lots of dollar signs and facts and figures and make it much more readable in a way, easier for President Trump to comprehend and not get distracted or bored by. Early in the administration, I interviewed Mike Pompeo, who was then the CIA director, and he said, you know what, the president likes, and these are Pompeo's words, killer graphics, and that's the way they learned to deliver intelligence to him.
And Trump's name was on every screen?
Well, not on every screen, but they found as many opportunities as they could to sort of make it about him and make him feel connected to the presentation and the briefing.
There's a lot in here about his relationship with President Putin. What insights did you get into how Trump thought he could deal with Putin and how Putin regarded President Trump?
You know, it's interesting. From the very beginning, this was right after the election, during the transition period when Trump was trying to staff his cabinet, he was in an interview, a job interview with one of his Secretary of State candidates, and he turned to Reince Priebus, who was set to become the White House Chief of Staff, and asked Priebus, you know, when can I meet Putin? I want to meet Putin. Can I meet him before my inauguration? And that would have been such an extraordinary breach of protocol to be meeting with the Russian president before having met with the NATO allies, before being inaugurated, while President Obama was still in office. But it was indicative of Trump's burning desire to have a relationship, a friendship, a bromance with Vladimir Putin. He saw Putin and still sees Putin as a strong man, as someone who has the leadership abilities and kind of muscular machismo that's to be admired. And throughout the book, there are moments where Trump is admiring of Putin. And he actually finally had his first meeting with Putin in Hamburg, Germany, on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit. And he met for about 2 hours in private with Putin. And afterwards, he told Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, who, by the way, has years of negotiating with Putin as the head of ExxonMobil. Trump told Tillerson, "I've got this. I understand Putin. I just spent 2 hours with him. I know more about him than you do. You don't need to advise me anymore. I got it under control."
And he expressed the opinion that, you know, Putin does not have an agenda of undermining U.S. interests, right? You can be friends.
That was definitely what the president said repeatedly to all of his aides. Tillerson, Pompeo, the entire national security firmament, the intelligence community was constantly trying to brief this president about the ways in which Putin tries to exploit American vulnerabilities and leap into situations where he can take some advantage. In fact, Rex Tillerson was trying to school the president gently, not in a patronizing way, but gently school him about, here's what Putin's doing every morning when he wakes up. He's looking for where we've got a hole, and he's going to dash over there, and we won't be fast enough to take advantage of it and stop him. And the president repeatedly rejected this, including rejecting the intelligence that he was brought constantly about the fact that Putin had directly intentionally interfered in the 2016 election. President Trump said, "Yeah, I don't think he's really doing that."
You write, this is the two of you in the book, Putin had developed a knack for manipulating Trump, making him believe that the two of them could get big things accomplished if they ignored their staffs and worked one-on-one. National security aides feared Putin knew how to feed the unusual combination of Trump's ego and insecurity, and how to cultivate conspiracies in his mind.
You know, there is this moment when Putin says to President Trump, you know, we could have a great relationship, but the people, the little people below us, they're against it. It is an exact quote. I want to be careful in what I say about this, but the paraphrase is basically, if we just, you know, the little people are rooting against us in our government. I understand that. And it totally speaks to Donald Trump's conspiracy theories about the deep state. You know, he believed his intelligence community, his national security community, his State Department, his Justice Department should be working for him and defending his image and his political, you know, power. But he also believed that they were out to get him. And it all started, honestly, with the FBI investigation of his campaign to try to figure out if any of the members of his campaign were coordinating in any way or encouraging Russian interference.
There's a fair amount in here about President Trump's temper. Give us an example.
There are a lot of examples. You highlighted one about the tank, which we also found really striking. But there are many of them. And one that I can think of that really got me was when he goes to Paris and he's on this trip with his chief of staff and the rest of his aides. And there's a special memorial event to honor the American dead at a memorial outside of Paris. And it's rainy. The president has just lost the midterms. If he doesn't admit that he lost the midterms, but Republicans took a shellacking in the House and the Democrats took control. And he is angry and brooding. And in Paris, it's raining and miserable. And he decides not to go to this particular scheduled event. Instead, John Kelly goes in his place, and there's a lot of videotape of and television coverage of the chief of staff taking a moment to honor the dead Marines who fought for America and lost their lives in Europe. And he gets wonderful coverage, and there's a ton of criticism of why Donald Trump opted not to do this beautiful and generous thing. He berates John Kelly and said it's all his fault that he's getting this bad press when Kelly returns from the visit. And he tells him this was a huge mistake. Why did you let me do this? never really acknowledging that it was Donald Trump's decision that he didn't want to go to this event.
I think it's only fair to point out that it's a high-pressure job, and there are other presidents known for rages directed at their staff and others.
That's right, although I would add, Dave, that this is a character trait that Trump has. We interviewed one of his former executives at the Trump Organization who described a scene when Donald Trump, then real estate mogul, purchased the Plaza Hotel and was renovating it in New York and just blew up at her and some of the other employees over the redesign of the bathroom. He thought that the green marble looked really cheap. He thought that the wooden doors of the armoire looked cheap, and he was yelling at them. It turns out, of course, that Donald Trump is the one who approved the selection of marble and the furniture, but he's famously short-tempered throughout his life, not only as president.
You both covered government for public officials for a long time, and I mean, I know the standards that you impose on yourselves as reporters of government and politics, and that when you cover officials, I mean, there are some tough stories, and there are also times you give people credit for doing the right thing or at least good faith efforts. And I know how important it is for you to talk to all sides of an issue, to be thorough and fair and open-minded. But on the last page of your book, you have this statement about Trump. By the fall of 2019, Trump was acting as if he were convinced of his own invincibility, believing he could wield the vast powers of his office in pursuit of his personal and political goals without accountability. He genuinely believed that his interests came first and that as president, he was above the law. And I'm wondering, what is it like to cover a public official after you've rendered such a harsh judgment about his fitness for office? Is it a different experience?
I don't think Phil and I have come to a conclusion about the president's fitness for office. What we have come to a conclusion about is that so many people who served at his shoulder for months and years are very worried about his fitness for office. We all know, as a point of fact, that he had no experience in public service before, nothing to speak of, and that's not absolutely unique for a politician. It's kind of unusual for a president. We feel strongly that our role as journalists is to share with you everything that we've learned from the people who knew him best. We choose this title, A Very Stable Genius, because it's the president's own words about himself. Now we hold that mirror up to the president, and we stress test it with the people who worked for him, the people he confided in, the people who saw him day in and day out in a way that we didn't. And this is really their judgment.
I also wanted to ask about the use of anonymous sources. You know, I was a daily newspaper reporter for 20 years covering government at the state and local level. And I kind of had a guideline that I would certainly use confidential sources for information. And if they showed that, you know, a politician was lazy or incompetent, I would report the information. But that if you wanted to render a judgment about somebody's character or competence, you kind of got to have your name on it for me to use that in the newspaper. And in the book, you have a quote attributed to, I guess it's a senior level administration official saying, "The guy is completely crazy. The story of Trump, a president with a horrible instincts and a senior level cabinet playing whack-a-mole." Another national security official you quote saying, "I've served with the man for 2 years. I think he's a long-term and immediate danger to the country." Do you have any qualms about anonymous quotes that are that, you know, these ad hominem attacks? And is it different with this president?
You know, Dave, I think Phil and I have a very similar rule of thumb to yours about this issue of judging someone's character and in an anonymous quote. I'll tell you why I feel that both of us were comfortable with this one, which is that it was illustrative of something we heard time and time again. This idea of the cabinet playing whack-a-mole with bad ideas that the president made without good information, without discipline, without a real process for assessing the best path forward. If we counted up how many times we heard something like that, it would be a large, large number. And I think that one of the important things about the anonymous sources here that you have to keep in mind is that some of these people did not speak to us in real time when these events were unfolding for a couple of reasons. They were, one, afraid of Donald Trump and his ability to retaliate against them, as he's proven very adept at with his very large Twitter megaphone. And another reason was some of them, in their DNA as national security or intelligence officials, they don't talk to reporters and they don't criticize a sitting president. But when we came around with a book and we said, this is for history, when we said, this is going to be the tome that explains Donald Trump's presidency, they felt compelled, while fearful, they still felt compelled to try to help us get it right, get history right. And that's why they came forward. And it took a lot of work. But I think the product is here now, and readers can make their own judgment about whether they feel it rings true. We know we're confident in it.
You know, I'm sure when you began this project, you had no idea that it would be published just as a trial would be beginning in the Senate for the president's impeachment. How has that affected, you know, I don't know, the impact, the reception of the book?
In a weird way, Dave, all the reporting that we did and all the new things we found out, the themes of what motivates this president, how he runs his shop, they all foreshadowed this moment in a way. I'm not saying they foreshadowed obstruction or they foreshadowed abuse of office. What they foreshadowed was a theme throughout the presidency. Donald Trump is interested in perpetuating his own power. It's a presidency of one, and it's escalating in the direction of lack of discipline and chaos, a den of dysfunction, as Phil Rucker put it once in a story. And here we are at this moment. Why is the president in so much hot water? Because the guardrails are gone. He was relying on Rudy Giuliani, who told him, hey, we can get some dirt on your number one political opponent, Joe Biden, in Ukraine. And the president asked the Ukraine president for a favor on a telephone call. And the favor was for the perpetuation of his own power. And that was to help him in his reelection and get some dirt on his then number one foe.
Hmm. Well, Philip Rucker, Carol Lenig, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
Carol Lenig is a national investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Philip Rucker is the paper's White House bureau chief. Their new book is A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. Marcus King is a 23-year-old from Greenville, South Carolina, who until now was best known for the southern rock and blues he made with the Marcus King Band. Now he's released his first solo album called El Dorado that represents a different direction in King's career. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of how soulful Marcus King's new music can be.
Wildflowers and wine. Old scratchy record plays in the background of our lives. We're still here dancing after all this time. Wildflowers and wine.
Marcus King sings in that new song about the quote-unquote old scratchy records he listens to. And you get the feeling that in preparing to make his new album El Dorado, King might have dusted off his Otis Redding and Solomon Burke records to study. As a guitarist who's arrived at his early 20s with a solid reputation as a blues prodigy, he's already restless for new areas of exploration. Perhaps seeking to make sure he doesn't alienate his old fans, however, he took care to make the second song on this new album a blues barn burner.
I was just a young and bouncing on my mama's knee. She said there's only one thing to set your soul free. Wasn't no easy street where I come from. There wasn't no sleep until the work was done. around the fires of hell. If you want a drink of water, got to go to the well. The cornerstone church trying to curse my soul. But the good Lord give me that rock and roll.
That song, called The Well, is typical of what Marcus King has done on the previous albums, but it's more the exception than the rule on El Dorado. What changed? Well, King moved to Nashville and struck up a friendship with Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys. The two started writing songs together, songs that sent King in a different direction toward a more rhythm and blues-based area. And Auerbach offered to produce a King solo album. It's yielded such lovely surprises as this soul ballad called Break.
You're falling apart, but don't let your heart break for nobody but me. Got a song guessing who you'll be blessing. Everyone's waiting to see. You think you're so smart, but don't let your heart.
With its falsetto vocal and the way the keyboards become more important than the guitar, Break is the clearest representation of Marcus King's new sound. King's road band has been, at least momentarily, sidelined here. The musicians Dan Auerbach assembled for the album are a collection of veteran session players, like keyboard player Bobby Wood and drummer Gene Chrisman, who have played on hits for artists ranging from Elvis Presley to Wilson Pickett to Willie Nelson. Their subtlety shines through on this gospel-inflected ballad, Beautiful Stranger.
Beautiful stranger, come here quite often. I don't know your name, but I know what you
So now the question is, which is the real Marcus King, Southern blues rocker or blue-eyed soul balladeer? Some combination of both? This feels like a turning point for him. But with Dan Auerbach co-writing every song on El Dorado, it's impossible to tell what King will do the next time he strikes out on his own. Whatever happens down the road, though, this album is a real beauty.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed El Dorado, the new solo album from Marcus King. Our guest, actor Tim Roth, may be best known for his roles in Quentin Tarantino films, including Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, where his attempt to rob a diner led to a memorable confrontation with Samuel L. Jackson's character. Roth is British, and he's appeared in more than 100 movies and TV productions on both sides of the Atlantic. He's currently starring in the Amazon series 10 Star. And he stars in a new film directed by Francois Girard called The Song of Names. Roth plays Martin Simmons, an Englishman who grew up in the 1930s, the son of a music publisher. On the eve of World War II, the family took in a 9-year-old violin prodigy, a Jewish child from Poland, and nurtured his talent. But he worried about his family back in Poland, which was overrun by the Nazis. In the 1950s, Martin's father spends a fortune to arrange a coming-out concert for the violinist, by then 21, who mysteriously doesn't show for the concert and disappears. In this scene, decades later, Martin has tracked him down. The violinist is played by Clive Owen. They're in the front seat of a minivan, speaking for the first time in 35 years. Roth's character Martin speaks first.
You have no idea, do you? Why did you do it?
I'm not sure you'd understand. You know, when I abandoned the Holy One, it took him 4 years to find me. Second use 35. Not bad.
Yeah, but your God didn't punish you, but maybe I will.
Oh, so would he. In time. Blessed be his name.
My father put everything he had into you. You ungrateful bastard! Hebrew lessons, bar mitzvah, violin. He treated you like a favorite son for 12 years, and then you just buggered off without a word. He thought you were dead, Dov. He lost everything that night. And 2 months later, he dies with your name on his lips.
And that's our guest, Tim Roth, in the new film, The Song of Names. Tim Roth, welcome to Fresh Air. Good to have you.
Thank you.
What appealed to you about this role, this project?
Well, originally when they brought it to me, it was about two Jewish families, and my character originally was Jewish. And so it had a quality of being a private conversation, in a sense. And I talked to the producer and to the director, and just to give my instant sort of reaction to the script. And I thought that it might be interesting if one side of the equation was not Jewish, and so didn't understand that community, and it was a mystery to him. So when he started to explore that and unravel that, we could take the audience along, or the audience that weren't of that of the Jewish religion, along with him on that kind of ride and that kind of that discovery, and they jumped on that. So I thought, well, these guys are excited and interesting, and the story was beautiful. It's just a love story in one respect. It's a love story between these two men, these two boys, then over three sort of sections of their life.
You know, this story is about beautiful music, but it's also very much about the Holocaust, because the solution to the mystery of this violinist's disappearance is connected to the Holocaust and the importance of remembering those who perished and honoring them, in this case with a remarkable piece of music. And, you know, it connects to something that I read about your own father. He changed the family name, didn't he, from Smith to Roth?
Yeah, he did. He was an American immigrant, came over to England and as a child, and then, I suppose, it has a similarity in that he had a rough childhood, and by the time he got to 17 years old, the war happened. And so then he joined up, which you shouldn't have been able to, but they took anyone at that point. And he joined the Air Force underage and became a tail gunner in bombers, and then survived for the duration, was pretty uneducated, but taught himself Italian, was stationed at the end on VE Day. I know he was in Italy at the time, and that was, you could choose to stay there. And he taught himself to speak Italian. He was fluent. But he thought better go back and see his parents. But he'd seen, not that he would talk about it much, but he'd seen awful things. And so he chose, because of, didn't have a good relationship with his family, decided to change his name. And he took a Jewish name, I believe a Swiss name in origin. I'm not sure. Swiss Jewish? I'm not sure. I can't remember the exact origin of it. But because of what he saw in the war, he came out of that, took a Jewish name, and as a consequence, I get invited to a lot of functions, which is rather pleasing.
And you have to explain that you never had a bar mitzvah.
Yeah, but I usually wait until, after the fact for that, because the food's really good.
But that was a conscious choice. I mean, he didn't convert to Judaism, but he wanted to honor the memory of those, huh?
Yeah. And I, he wouldn't, like I say, my father-in-law is the same, and he was in Korea, but he discusses the war very little. And so I had to glean what I could over the years of my childhood with my father. You got little snippets now and again, but very, very few. Right. Yeah, I think it was a deeply distressing time for him.
Yeah. Well, for your dad to survive many years in the Royal Air Force was kind of remarkable in and of itself, wasn't it?
And a tail gunner, which is not exactly known for survival.
You became well-known in the U.S. when you appeared in Quentin Tarantino's film Reservoir Dogs in, I think, 1992.
Right.
And then you had an ongoing relationship with him in several other films. And I thought I'd play a clip from Pulp Fiction, which is maybe one of the better-known appearances by you. I mean, this is the one that I think of when I think of Tim Roth. This is a scene where you're in a diner with your girlfriend, played by Amanda Plummer. You're criminals. You're a stick-up team. And in this conversation, you're talking about, you know, what kind of places to stick up. And you think, why not rob a place like this restaurant? And at the end of the scene, that's what happens. Let's listen.
Nobody ever robs restaurants. Why not? Bars, liquor stores, gas stations. You get your head blown off sticking at one of them. Restaurants, on the other hand, you catch with their pants down. They're not expecting to get robbed. Not as expecting anyway.
I bet you could cut down on the hero factor in a place like this.
Correct. Same as banks, these places are insured. Manager, you don't give a. He's just trying to get you out the door before you start plugging the diners. Waitresses, forget it. No way they're taking a bullet for the register. Busboy, getting paid $1.50 an hour. Really give a you're stealing from the owner? Customers sitting there with food in their mouths. They don't know what's going on. One minute they're having a Denver omelette. Next minute someone's sticking a gun in their face. See, I got the idea. The last liquor store we stuck up, remember? Mm-hmm. All the customers kept coming in.
Yeah.
You got the idea, taking their wallets. Now that was a good idea.
Thank you.
Made more from the wallets than we did from the register.
Yes, we did.
A lot of people come to restaurants.
A lot of wallets.
Pretty smart, huh?
Pretty smart. I'm ready. Let's do it right now, right here. Come on.
Right. Same as last time, remember? Your crowd control. I handle employees.
I love you, pumpkin.
I love you, honey bunny.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
Some crisp Tarantino dialogue, a kiss and a hold up.
Yeah, right?
That's Tim Roth from Pulp Fiction. Tell us about getting to know Tarantino and connecting with him originally.
Originally, my introduction to America had been through Robert Altman when I did Vincent and Theo with him, and then had to come over and do press here. So, you know, and I got an agent during that time and then worked up in New York, went down to LA and was thinking, I've got to get out of here. I've got to go home to London. And then they made me stay. My agents made me stay and sit about for a bit. So I started reading scripts. And this one arrived. This one, you know, she plunked on my table in my flat. And
That's Reservoir Dogs, right?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Reservoir Dogs. So that happened. And then within 20 pages, I was reaching for the phone. So I've got to do this. I have to meet this guy. And then I went in and I notoriously didn't read for stuff because I'm not very good at it. And so he managed to persuade me through various sort of beers to do that late at my flat and after a long day. And you know, we read everything. We had the best time and he gave me the job. And that was the beginning of my relationship. Well, that's a shorthand version of what it was. And it was the beginning of my relationship. And it's extraordinary when you play that clip there from Pulp Fiction. The one thing that is remarkable about Quentin's dialogue is he has done all of your improvising for you. He's already jumped the gun on that. It arrives and it just falls out of you. Sometimes you have to ask him, you know, what his musical rhythm is for a particular sentence. And he will read it out for you, he'll say it, and you go, oh, I get it. But a lot of the work that you to make things seem natural and also not natural, which is, you know, it's not realism necessarily, but you know, it's a mixture of a few different worlds. He's already done that work for you in his writing. He's an absolutely remarkable writer. So, you know, we ended up having quite a good relationship, me and Quentin, from Reservoir Dogs through to Pulp Fiction through to Hateful Eight.
You know, the interesting thing, you said that you didn't want to audition. You didn't want to read for the part because you don't do that well or didn't do
no,
that
no,
well.
No, I'm just crap at it. to be. I mean, I had the.
Yeah, how do you convince people to give you a role without doing that? I mean.
Well, I figured you lose 50% of the jobs by not reading, and then, you know, 50% of the jobs you get. I don't know what balance was. My reasoning was, but I was so bad at it that I'd lost enough jobs in Britain by being really awful in auditions that I after I got enough films under my belt, I just said, well, if you want to see if I can act, go and look at those films. If you don't like them, don't hire me. And so, you know, when I met with Quentin, he wanted me to read, and Harvey Keitel was there, and it was very for the Reservoir Dogs thing, and it was very important to Harvey that I read, and I wouldn't do it. And then we went out to a diner, and we sat, and I still wouldn't do it. And then I took Quentin to this pub that I used to go to, close to where I was living at the time, little flat that I had, and we had a few beers, and we went to the 7-Eleven, we went back to my flat, and we read everything. But I think it's probably the last time I've ever done that.
You didn't go to drama school, right? You weren't trained as an actor, really, right? How did you get into it?
I went, which was common in my family. My dad could draw. My mother was a painter, but she became a teacher. She was a primary school teacher. My dad became a journalist, in fact. But in our family was drawing and painting. So I went to art college. I went to art school. But before I did that, before I was due to go there, a friend of mine at school, at high school, me and him became obsessed with Samuel Beckett. And we would just annoy people with our behavior. I don't know what that was. But there was as a result of that, me and this friend of mine went to audition for a school play. It backfired completely. We did it as a joke, and it backfired completely. And I got the part. And so I had to do an all-singing, all-dancing performance of Dracula. It was called Dracula Spectacular. It was far from spectacular. But I had to do it in front of all the school bullies, everyone's a critic kind of situation. But I loved it. There was this extraordinary woman who ran a drama department who I was not, you know, I met her just through that, this joke that backfired, and she took me in. And so I fell in love with it. And I started, even before I went to art school, I started auditioning for, little community theatres and pub theatres. And she showed me what auditioning was. She showed me how to find out about them. She sent me to these community theatres. And I just quietly fell in love with it. But I did go on to art school. But at the about a year and a half in, they sat me down and said, you're taking the piss. So you should go off and see if you can become an actor. In the meantime, we'll keep this place open for you, and you can come back if it doesn't work out. And it worked out.
You're taking a piss. That's a way of saying you're not putting yourself into this.
You're not investing in. I mean, you know, there's plenty of people out there who would die for a place at this. It was Camberwell Art School in London, South London. It's one of the best fine art schools you can get into. And I was wasting the space. There's plenty of other people who could have used it and needed to be there, but my eye was on something else. As soon as I became besotted with this bizarre job of acting, and as soon as I sort of dipped my toe in,
Right, and I learned from reading about you that there was this phenomena of pubs that had little theaters upstairs.
Yeah,
we were doing a lot of that.
Yeah, I did a trilogy of plays in a pub theater, and that got me going. And then I would do these community theaters in London, and yeah. But the pub theater was interesting, and it's still, I think it still is quite the thing in London and around England. Yeah, pub theaters. Yeah.
All right. Then there's your first role in front of a camera. This is pretty remarkable. How did you get this part?
Well, I was doing what out-of-work actors do, or is one of those things that is available to out-of-work actors, or was at that point, which was selling advertising to people who couldn't afford it and didn't want it over the phone. So you would be sitting in these booths in this office, and you would just be given a list of... what do they call them now? Where you got
call centers, right?
Yeah, it's such a scam. Anyway, so you had a script, and you would, when you got someone on the phone, you would try and persuade them to part with their money. You know, terrible thing. And so I was cycling back at night across London, and I got a flat tire on my bike, and I called into this little community theatre that I'd worked at, and they didn't have a tire repair kit, but they told me about this audition for this television film that was being made, which was called Made in Britain, and I went up for it, and three shots at it, I ended up getting it.
And it was the lead role.
It was the lead role. So I went, a third callback that I got, I went early, about an hour early, to the offices. And I'd been, you know, twice there before, so I knew that it looked over this park, this little park's in Soho, so in London. So I went, and they said, oh, no, you're early. You're supposed to be here at 12. I said, oh, don't worry about it. I'll go and wait in the park across the road, and then I'll come back in. And I knew that they'd be watching me through the window. So I went into character a bit and got stopped by the police. And then a mate of mine who was a punk at the time came through. We got into a bit of trouble. And then, you know, an hour later, I went in for the audition and got the job. But my real audition, was in the park.
Wow.
Was them watching, and they told me that at the end of shooting. Yeah.
Right, and your character was a teenage skinhead, so...
It was a Nazi skinhead, yeah, right. in the school system and then into the juvenile prison system, yeah.
Well, Tim Roth, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tim Roth stars in the new film, The Song of Names.